I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, we'll have a Friday conversation about online games like EverQuest and World of Warcraft. They've got better sales than top box office films. But first, Barack Obama's controversial pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, is speaking out for the first time since the political firestorm over his old sermons and ties to Obama erupted in March. Tonight on PBS, he tells Bill Moyers the sound bites of his sermons that seem to be everywhere were circulated in an effort to bring down Obama.
I think they wanted to communicate that I am unpatriotic, that I am an American, that I am filled with hate speech, that I have a cult at Trinity United Church of Christ. And by the way, guess who goes to his church? Hint, hint, hint.
Reverend Wright is also scheduled to speak to the Detroit chapter of the NAACP on Sunday night and then at the National Press Club Monday morning. John Harwood is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for the New York Times. He joins us from New Orleans. John, why is this happening now? Why is Jeremiah Wright speaking out now?
Well, I think Jeremiah Wright wants to try to defend himself. He's been on the receiving end of an awful lot of vitriol. And is taking the chance after some weeks after Barack Obama dealt with it himself in that speech that was very well received in Philadelphia to set the story as he wants it to be told. And I don't think people can begrudge him that.
Well, and by the way, we apologize. You're on a phone line down there in New Orleans, and we'll you know, bear with it. But do we know if Barack Obama is a part of setting up these, or are they completely separate?
I would think that would have been done separately. I'm not sure, but I think at this point the Barack Obama campaign is keeping a very arm's-length relationship with Jeremiah Wright. That, in fact, started to happen at the outset of his campaign when he was disinvited from giving the invocation at Obama's campaign kickoff in Springfield, Illinois. And I think they're not trying to minimize the issue and try to put the issue behind them. I think they're not trying to have a high level of involvement right now.
Well, it puts Jeremiah Wright's comments back in the public sphere, and that was going to happen anyway because there was an anti-Obama ad that the Republican Party in North Carolina was planning to run next week anyway. Now, there were reports this morning that ad had been pulled at the request of candidate John McCain, but no, the North Carolina Republican Party says they're going to run this ad. Let's listen to a few seconds.
For 20 years, Barack Obama sat in his pew listening to his pastor.
And then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America.
Now, Beth Perdue and Richard Moore.
As we said, at least one North Carolina television station has rejected the ad. But, you know, what does it say to you, John Harwood, that John McCain claims to have condemned the ad and asked the Republican Party there in North Carolina not to run it, but they're going to run it anyway?
Well, John McCain has some control over what the larger Republican apparatus does, but not total control. And John McCain himself has a fine line to walk here. Does he want to paint Barack Obama as out of the mainstream of American thought? Yes, he does. Does he want to avoid anything that would appear to be race baiting? Yes, he does. And as he tries to walk that balance, there are going to be many, many actors acting independently of his campaign or even on the fringes of his campaign who he's not going to be able to control. So that balance is going to be hard for him to bring off. And the challenge for Barack Obama is to figure out in places that he needs to win if he's the nominee, how does he react to that? He's not going to win North Carolina in any case if he's the nominee against John McCain, but his concern is how it affects the race in the state.
You mean if John McCain is the nominee against a Democrat in North Carolina?
I'm sorry, yeah. Yes. If Barack Obama is the Democratic nominee, his chances of carrying North Carolina are slim and none.
Right. Well, you're in New Orleans, as we said. John McCain was there yesterday blasting the Bush administration's response to Hurricane Katrina. He called it disgraceful. But what are officials there saying to that? What are they saying about his record at the time and his votes at the time?
Well, what you see is you now have a Republican governor in the state who himself has run on a reform message. And when John McCain spoke last night to a business audience, he sounded very much in the spirit of Bobby Jindal, the new Republican governor. They're both blasting not only the federal response to Katrina, but also to some degree the state's response, because remember, Bobby Jindal is replacing the Democratic governor who was in charge there. So that doesn't get John McCain in trouble, really, with officials in New Orleans, because he's trying to surf on that same reform wave that Jindal rode into office.
Yeah, although we're hearing that some officials are saying, yes, but at the time, you know, where were you?
He was actually with George Bush.
Yeah. Yeah. John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for The New York Times. Back to Reverend White, we're assuming that, the Obama campaign is on some pins and needles this weekend.
The Obama campaign faces a very direct challenge, and that is to figure out a way to improve their performance with downscale, working-class white Democrats. They got pounded with that constituency in Ohio. They got pounded with that constituency in Pennsylvania. That doesn't necessarily mean they can't do well in the fall with those voters who are, after all, Democrats who were voting in Democratic primaries and had another appealing option. But he's got a challenge in Indiana to try to stop her momentum and lock up this nomination. And to do that, he needs to do better with that group of voters. And so he has to figure out a way to take his message, which has been largely about political reform, and put it more in bread and butter terms.
John Harwood, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, we thought we'd take a break from the real world today to spend some time in the virtual one. In fact, over 50 million people are doing that. They're playing games like World of Warcraft, EverQuest, and Second Life. And the makers of these games can take in more money in one day than movie makers can from a big day at the box office. People spend more time playing these games than they do working, eating, sleeping combined. The games are known as MorePegs, massively multiplayer online role-playing games. Their attraction is simple. They provide the player with a whole new world to live in.
It's a completely different set of rules. You're a completely different person while you're there. Just to have that kind of freedom and, you know, be able to get away with it and not have anybody question you, I mean, it makes it a world in and of itself.
That's just one of the players profiled in a fascinating new documentary that dives into the virtual world. It's called Second Skin. Joining us in the studio, producer Peter Brower. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
And also on the line from the Hot Docs Film Festival in Toronto, director Juan Carlos Pinheiro. Juan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And Peter, why don't you start? For people who haven't played, what happens in these games? We see people at their computer terminals, they're watching the screens, but what are they doing?
The whole essence of these games is that they provide a place where lots of people, like thousands of people, can come together online and cooperate and play together to accomplish some complex task. And so what happens is you have real complex human relationships that play out in these virtual spaces and are very rich and rewarding for all the players who participate.
Players create characters. Some of them look a little bit like the players. Most of the time they look like the players sort of wished they looked.
Well, I think one of the things that happens in these games when people create their avatars is they want to create either a representation of themselves, kind of like an extension of who they are, but they're many times freer. They're allowed to be more than what they are in their real daily life. So, yes, sometimes they look like themselves. Sometimes they look absolutely different. Really, the idea is the freedom and ability to express yourself in a space where you're not limited by the physical appearance or, you know, class or anything that really restricts us in our daily lives.
Yeah, Peter, tell us more about, you know, the word avatar.
It's just, you know, this is your representation in a virtual space. And basically all of these games, there is some body. You see it in front of you normally in 3D, and that is how you interact with all the other players in the world. And
as a player, you begin questing, you fight these monsters. And one of the players, Peter, in your film describes the feeling of being in a game as a real memory, like a memory of a friend's wedding.
Absolutely.
Being a part of a guild, being a part of these essentially virtual families, becomes very, very important. In the same way that you have, you know, friends and family at home, that's the same thing that happens in a virtual space. You create these incredible bonds with people, many times that are deeper than the ones you create in real life, because of the fact that you're not inhibited by social norms.
But it's also clear that some of these players become addicted. We meet Dan, who starts seeing the virtual world from his screen as he walks down the street. Peter, you're nodding yes.
Yeah, when I first started playing World of Warcraft, I started being addicted. I mean, I was playing 12 hours a day. I was really deep into it, and I was actually shirking my responsibilities of making this film. And actually, Juan at one point said, come into the office, get away from your computer.
He pulled you back.
He pulled
me back.
Stay
away from the computer.
Exactly. But the truth is that, you know, I think for a lot of people who maybe aren't totally happy with their real lives, who have things that they're confronting that are very heavy for them, these are a place where they can go, and they're very intense, so you focus very hard on the game, and it allows you to forget about those other problems, at least temporarily. And so I think there are certain people who are willing to forget maybe too much, and they get too pulled into the game to the point that, you know, their real life starts slipping, and they might lose a job, or they might, you know, have trouble paying their bills. And those are real issues. But ultimately, is it the game, or is it, you know, the person's own sense of responsibility?
Well, you, in fact, profile one gamer whose wife, you shot for a long time because over the course of the film she became pregnant and had twins, and he decided to, you know, maybe cut back a little on his gaming. And by the way, gaming is also part dating game. We meet people who find love while they're playing the game, including Kevin and Heather. They meet in a game called EverQuest. Here's a scene where Kevin talks about previous relationships he's had with three other women he'd met online. Let's listen.
The person turned out to be someone completely different from what they espoused to be, and was rather violent. The other person wielded a knife at me. In her defense, she did come from a really, really long way away. But still, no reason to wield a knife. Number three was a married woman with children who was supposed to be separated and wasn't. That was a roller coaster.
I think that Kevin is a real exception. He's a flirt online, and it's pretty interesting because in real life, he's quite shy. He's very held back until you get to know him, and then he's hysterically funny. So I think that these online spaces, at least for him, provided him a place to let that inner, more like macho, more like take control type of person come out and flourish. And so for him, it was a real dating thing where in the real world, you know, he's not the most handsome guy. He's not.
Oh, he's kind of cute.
He's kind of cute. He's all right. And, you know, but at the same time, in the virtual world, he is this muscly hero.
Oh,
he
goes,
he has a big shield. He defends people. He's, you know, at the center of every fight. And so it gives him an opportunity to shine in a way that I don't think he felt like he shined in real life. And for Kevin and Heather, you know, they met and fell in love with each other from the inside out. And we hear that all the time about these people, that you meet someone, you learn about their insides, you see how they interact in high-pressure situations, you see if they're chivalrous, if they're kind, if they're funny, and you see all of that before you see what they look like.
Well, you also insert an animation into the documentary film, and you can sort of see as he's, for instance, moving into her house, that perhaps in his mind he is that knight in shining armor, as we keep seeing some of the animation of how he envisions himself online. So does some of it actually carry over offline into real life and kind of buttress how someone views themselves?
People do claim many times that their online experience brings them to a better understanding of who they are, and they can then bring that to reality. So that connection with their avatar and that ability to understand themselves better in an online space allows for them to bring, you know, useful and resourcefulness to their real-life confidence. Many people talk about being better leaders, having more fulfilling lives, because an online game allows them that freedom that they were able to kind of test, you know, essentially their personality.
We're speaking with Juan Carlos Pinheiro and Peter Brower. Their new film, Second Skin, looks at the world of Morpegs, massively multiplayer online role-playing games. And guys, I want to move on to another part of gaming. That's playing long enough to get more weapons, to be a more powerful player. One game designer describes it this way.
If you really think about it, this breastplate that dropped off a monster I killed is really worth, you know, 55.7 hours. You know, it's really what it boils down to. It's not money, it's time.
And that brings us to something you describe as gold farming. Peter, this is where people pay other players to play for them long enough to earn them virtual gold to buy these weapons. There are whole companies, almost techno sweatshops, set up in China to do this?
Well, they would take exception to
yes.
the sweatshop label.
Yeah.
But certainly, yes. I mean, the New York Times estimated that there was 100,000 people in China who do this.
And you are kidding. Wait, 100,000 people sit and play games paid by other people just to get the hours?
Yes. I mean, there's 10 million people in the world who play World of Warcraft, okay? What percentage of those people have substantial disposable incomes and at the same time have a real drive to succeed in the game? Maybe they are a lawyer and they don't have the time to put in on their character, but they do have the money to buy their character what they need. And so they pay someone in China to do this for them. And basically, you know, the way economies work is if there's a supply and there's a demand, then because of the internet, because the world is much smaller because of all the networks we've created, there, of course, is going to be a natural progression to this huge economy that's developed.
And meanwhile, the gamers that you profile, who are the ones who sit for 11 hours, you know, surrounded by the empty Snicker wrappers and stuff and play these games, they hate these. Sure. They can tell when somebody is a gold farmer.
You're absolutely right. That there are different things that people notice, cultural essential norms inside an online game, where people say that person's not acting like a regular player. They're acting like a gold farmer. Even inside a game where people are ogres and elves and such things like that, you can create this bias just created on the way that someone is playing. So you look at someone and say, that's a gold farmer. Well, gold farmers, generally speaking, people consider them to be Chinese or at least of Asian origin. And in that sense, you create a sort of racism built into this concept of a virtual world.
Huh. Well, we mentioned also the addictive nature of the game. I want to go back to Dan. This is the fellow who starts the film with a good job and a girlfriend. He becomes addicted to his game. Here's how he describes it.
It came to a point when I went outside and everything was just blurred and my mind was just completely focused on the game. I would actually see the graphics of the game just played out in my head. And my ears, they felt like there was a voice just pressing my head. My ears would ring. And everything in the real world just began to look like it was fake.
Peter, you've beautifully animated this, so we see Dan's point of view as he walks streets and common things turn into monsters. You know, you half expect him to whip out a sword and slay a postman. It's so bad, Dan goes to a support group run by a woman in your film whose son, an addicted player, killed himself. So this can get very serious. But Dan, on the other hand, eventually throws off his addiction. How does he do that?
He threw off his addiction through a lot of hard work. For him, it was a matter of he had to heal. He had a very painful bad back over time and a lot of exercise. He worked through a lot of that. And ultimately, he decided to focus on what was important to him. And what was that was putting together the life that, you know, he had built before he started playing these games and, you know, started working very hard and pushing away from the people who were holding him back.
Yeah. You know we're going to hear from gamers saying, you've just focused on the negative. There's nothing wrong with us. But in fact, there are some people for whom virtual reality is a blessing. Juan, tell us about Andrew. You first met him online.
Andrew Munkle, then we met in the game called Second Life. And we talked to him, and he was a great guy. And then we went to meet him in real life, and he had cerebral palsy. He couldn't leave his wheelchair. He could only use one arm. He could not speak, so he typed to us his answers when we asked him questions. The whole difference between his online persona was that he was completely normal. We had no idea of this disability. We had no conception of how difficult it was for him. And then in real world, you know, you unconsciously make all these assumptions about someone when they have a disability. But online, you have a complete ability just to disregard any physical, you know, problems.
He wasn't the only disabled gamer we spoke to. We actually interviewed a couple where the woman was deaf, and she started a relationship with a man in Second Life, and I think it was several months before he learned that she was completely deaf, and they started a romance, and when we met them, I believe they were engaged, and he learned sign language so that when they met for the first time in reality, they could communicate like they do in Second Life, where they just have to type to each other. So you can become whoever you want to be. And that includes, you know, disabled people are really enabled to just be your average Joe, which is really what I think a lot of disabled people want, is they just want to be looked at like everyone else.
That's Peter Brower. He's the producer. Juan Carlos Pinheiro, the director of the new documentary Second Skin. For more information about the movie, go to our website, here-now.org. Peter, I'm going to ask you first, then Juan. After seeing on screen the impact of games on other people, what about you? Do you still play?
I still play World of Warcraft, not nearly as much as I used to, but I actually have a really dear friend from high school who I totally reconnected with through the game, and I love to play with him.
What's your favorite part of it?
It's called player versus player, and I basically, it's like a game of capture the flag where you can kill the opposing players, and I really enjoy just going out and playing that for an hour or two here or there.
Just a thought about that aspect. Yeah, I really enjoy killing the opponents, you know, killing maybe your high school friend as an avatar, you know, the violence aspect of it. Or
I would say, you know, the violence in the game in World of Warcraft is very stylized. It's largely just spells and visual effects, so it's not very bloody. And at the same time, like, the reason I like playing against other players is that I know that they have just as good a chance to get me as I have them.
And Juan, you know, you're the one who pulled Peter, you know, told him to step away from the computer when he was getting too addicted. Do you play still?
I do play, of course, but I play console games. I'm not too much of an MMOer. So right now I am busily mastering myself on a Super Smash Brothers Brawl for the Wii.
So you've moved away from the computer screen games and you're now into the Wii, you know, holding the remote and doing it that way.
Yeah, I tend to stay more with console games like Nintendo all the way up through the Xbox 360.
And when you say MMOer, remind us?
Massively multiplayer online role-playing games.
And they made a movie about it. It's called Second Skin. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And for more on Peter and Juan's film, go to our website, here-now.org. Okay, after the news, punk rocker Greg Graffin from Bad Religion gets Humanist of the Year, Here and Now. President Bush said today that tax rebates, some of which will be in the mail next week, will help offset high prices. But he admitted it's obvious our economy is in a slowdown. Well, historian Kevin Phillips says nothing is obvious in our economy. In fact, he compares deceptive economic statistics to WMDs in the run-up to the Iraq War. Kevin says, and joins us from the studios of WABE in Atlanta, his new book is Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. So, Kevin, don't be shy. What do you really think about statistics?
Well, there's a fellow that works in statistics named John Williams. He says it's Pollyanna creep. And I think that's what it is. It's not some big conspiracy. It's not one administration. It's really most administrations over four decades. And they have just tried to make these statistics a little happier, a little less troubling, a little more encouraging, a little more deceptive.
Well, let's start by looking at jobs statistics. You write that JFK had so-called discouraged workers taken out of the unemployment numbers. These are workers who are unemployed but who've stopped looking for work. Then the Reagan administration boosted employment numbers by adding members of the military. The Clinton administration took long-term discouraged workers completely off the tally. These workers are now called the hidden unemployed. And as a result of all of these changes, we now have six different numbers for unemployment, levels U1 through U6.
And if you look at the U3 numbers, these are the ones that are officially released and called unemployment. But U6 includes a lot more people who aren't looking, who have given up and that sort of thing. Basically, the unemployment numbers that come out of the U3 have been running in the high fours and the low fives. The unemployment numbers that come out of the U6 have been running between 9 and 10.
That's twice as high. Let's move to the Consumer Price Index. That's the measure of the average change in prices over time of this metaphorical basket of goods and services that's said to represent the economy. You say the Nixon administration first removed food and energy from the Consumer Price Index, or CPI. Reagan made further substitutions, including, and this is tricky, substituting a rental equivalent for home ownership, so rents instead of mortgages. But that doesn't take into account the inflation of taxes, fees, or interest rates on mortgages. We're going to have more on that in a minute. And then the Clinton administration recalculated the CPI based on retail and financial sectors instead of traditional manufacturing sectors.
Yes, there are lots of different approaches to the cuteness of CPI. The most important thing that's happened in the last 10 years, really, was late in the Clinton years, where they abandoned the notion of a fixed basket of products. In other words, you measured the same thing in 1996 as you had in 1993 and the same as you had in 1986. And what they did is they set up a sort of floating package where if people thought that it was better to buy a cheap cut of steak than hamburger, you would substitute what they were perceived to be shifting towards. Now, generally speaking, they built in then a mathematical equation that would reduce the weighting of the thing that was getting more expensive and increase the weighting of the thing that was getting cheaper. Now, in the old days when they worked with a basket of goods, the basket of goods stayed the same, and
right.
You weren't free to make a little tuck here and a little nip there.
Right. You report the high cost of hamburger, not the cheap cost of steak.
Exactly.
You say there was no conspiracy, but it seems like a blatant attempt to make the economy look better than it is.
Oh, I think that part of it you really have to presuppose. But cynics thought that the real motivation that they had was to reduce the inflation rate so that they would have a basis for not producing significant cost of living increases in Social Security, not having to raise pension benefits, because this is a period, the late 80s and early 1990s, when the federal budget deficit was really getting pretty severe. And it's understandable that politicians wanted some way to minimize the deficit. So what they wanted to do was reduce the amount of growth that would have to go into pensions and Social Security, which they did, this is my interpretation, by denying Americans the true meaning and value of inflation.
Do you think this is why wages haven't increased in several decades, or at least, relative to inflation?
It's conceivable that if you go back for a period of 15 years or so, that there's been a considerable understatement of inflation that has minimized cost of living wage increases, pension increases, and minimized Social Security increases.
Do you think that there's a direct line from some of these changes to the current financial crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis?
I think that there is some relationship between the changes that were made in the way that the Consumer Price Index dealt with home prices back in the early 1980s. And several of the experts who've looked at these numbers suggest that this was one of the reasons why too many real estate loans were made in the late 1980s in a very speculative and loose way, and there was too much of a bubble. Statistics were suggesting that home prices were not the problem that in fact they were, because they were measuring something else.
As we said, they were measuring rental equivalents.
And of course, in this decade, you had the same problem when the price of housing was rising very rapidly, say from 2001 to 2006 or 7. The statistics did not pick it up. They picked up this owner's equivalent rental and minimized the effect of rising home ownership costs and inflation. And that really understated inflation at a time when it was very important to the government to have very, very low interest rates based on pretending that there really wasn't much inflation.
We haven't even touched on the gross domestic product. You write, Johnson created a unified budget which included Social Security. That allowed the surplus in the Social Security to mask the emerging deficit in the federal budget. But is there perhaps a point? Is there something to the thinking on the part of administration? Gee, we're not lying. We're just presenting different numbers. It'll be more encouraging to the economy.
Well, it would be more encouraging perhaps to mismanagement of the economy. What happens with bad statistics that overestimate the happy face and underestimate the problems developing is that encourages people to act based on a happy face and to think they can stretch things and speculate and game things in a way that they can't. I would conclude that that sort of statistic encourages sectors of the economy to be careless, to think that they've got more leeway for getting away with games and things that the economy can't really afford. And I think we've seen that in statistics in the private sector, believe me, are just as bad or worse. You've seen all these things that have come out with the different types of financial instruments, and nobody knows what they're worth. So the statistics and the quality of information has been lacking all across the economic spectrum. What we need for intelligent decisions is the best possible data. When we have the worst disclosure and flawed data, we get bad decisions.
That's Kevin Phillips. We're talking about his article in Harper's. It's titled Numbers Racket, Why the Economy is Worse Than We Know. Kevin's also author of the new book, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Let's get some of your thoughts in here. On Tuesday, we spoke with retired Army Colonel Ken Allard, one of 75 military analysts recruited by the Pentagon, to be part of a secret program to deliver Pentagon talking points to the media. The New York Times broke the story last Sunday. Alan Rothberg of Charlotte, North Carolina writes, "Thank you for your outstanding reporting on the Pentagon analyst story. Perhaps the network news reporters are embarrassed by all this because yours was the only coverage I've heard since the story broke. Even this week's White House press briefings made no mention of it, so thank you." Gardner A. Cadwallader of Philadelphia found it ironic that on one show we had a segment about the Pope's visit to the U.S., followed by one on that Texas polygamy sect accused of arranging marriages for underage girls. He writes, "You asked if that whole Texas sect should be legally responsible for abuse if they were all aware of it. Would you ask the Roman Catholic Church this same question you asked about this tiny group in Texas? It's not as though the behavior of the Catholic priests has not been known. I've heard of it my whole life from Catholic boyhood friends, and I'm not a Catholic. If I knew, it's a sure bet that every parent of a Catholic boy knew every priest knew, and I bet the Pope knew as well." Well, we also spoke recently with Robin Nagel, honorary anthropologist in residence for the New York City Department of Sanitation. Brian Evans, who helped set waste disposal policy in Merrimack, Massachusetts, loved the segment, but was disappointed that we used the word garbage generically. He says it's cheaper for towns when hiring contractors to think of waste in categories, with garbage as organic matter, the way they did it when he was a kid.
We had two municipal pickups. One was for trash, one was for garbage. And the garbage was said to go off to the pig farm to slop the pigs. And today, when you put your contract out, you end up paying a lot more money if you're not able to show where you have placed tires, appliances, home furnishings, and whatnot. There are a lot more entanglements there than just pushing around decomposing waste.
Brian, thank you. As Michael from The Office would say, we're not perfect.
Guess what? I have flaws. What are they? Oh, I don't know. I sing in the shower. Sometimes I spend too much time volunteering.
We spoke with a U.S. News and World Report editor about career lessons that could be learned from the hit TV show The Office, and Thomas Cenieri was outraged. He writes, "What a ridiculous segment combining what's the funniest show on TV with ridiculous advice from professionals about what each character should do to get ahead in their jobs. Have you missed the whole point of the show?" Well, Thomas has a point. Any career counselor advising the characters would tell them to run for their lives. And finally, I got a letter from Vietnam this week. You might remember Kong, our translator in Vietnam, who'd also been a close friend of journalist David Halberstam. It was Kong's wish to come to America. Sadly, he finally did, but to attend a memorial service for Halberstam, who died last April 23rd in a car accident. This week, Kong sent his many friends in the U.S. a picture. You can see it at our website. It shows several items on a table, including the sign that reserved Kong's seat at David's memorial. Here is his letter. "Dear friends in New World, April 23rd is the first anniversary for David Halberstam. We held the checkout ceremonial party for him. I've never sent greetings or gifts to David on his birthday. Instead, we have something for him the day he leaves. You look to the day you check in. We check out. My wife kept the gate and door wide open to make sure that he could get into my house to have a meal with us. The incense sticks were lit next to his photo. We believe that when the incense is finished, that means he finished his meal and we could start. Bon appetit. Take your time, David. Neither drive in nor take it away, Burger King." On our journeys in Vietnam, I often remind tourists, please return the key to the front desk. Make sure to clear the bills. Empty your safety box. Some listen, some don't, some do it in a hurry, some miss this or that. Then Kong, a Buddhist, closed with this thought. Life is check out and recheck in. Best, Kong. If you'd like to send a letter, our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Back in a minute with the humanist of the year, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That's the band Bad Religion, one of the greatest punk rock bands ever, according to the host of the Punk Station on XM Radio. The group formed in 1980 when the members were still in high school, and as the name suggests, they often rail against religion. This is Atheist Peace from Bad Religion's 2004 album, The Empire Strikes First. Other songs reflect on evolution. The Grand Delusion asks, why does morality have to come from a god? This is the Thinking Man's Punk, partially because lead singer Greg Graffin is also a scientist with a PhD in zoology from Cornell University. He's got the academic credentials to get into a hefty debate about the existence of God. Tomorrow, Harvard University's humanist chaplaincy will present Greg Graffin with a Lifetime Achievement Award in Cultural Humanism. It's an honor that went to novelist Salman Rushdie last year. You might remember Rushdie called last year's shindig Atheistmas, sort of a Christmas for atheists. Greg Graffin joins us now from a studio at Cornell. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
The humanist chaplain at Harvard, who's been a frequent guest on this program, Greg Epstein, told us, your songs are like humanist prayers. Now, is that weird to you? Because I'm wondering if you're asking prayers to whom?
Well, I think if you look at prayer as an act that you do with the hope of getting an answer, then I don't really see these much as prayers, because I don't think there's anyone out there to answer the kinds of questions that we ask in the songs.
Talking about you today in the office sent us to the American Heritage Dictionary. We know that an atheist doesn't believe in the existence of God. An agnostic doesn't deny that God might exist, but believes that you can't ever prove that. So where are you there?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't bill myself as an atheist. What I bill myself as is a naturalist. I subscribe to the hypothesis that no gods exist. However, a naturalist believes in something greater, and that is that we can come to an agreement on the truth in the world because we can use the tools of science, that is observation, verification, and discovery, and we can all agree on what is true and what is not. Now, from the scientific perspective, if there was ever any evidence that God existed that could be verified, then anyone who's holding that position would be first in line to say, I'm now a believer in God.
Tell me some of the ways you've expressed some of your belief system in your music.
Boy, that is a tough question.
Yeah.
Because I'm really adamant about not presenting Bad Religion songs as pieces of science. Bad Religion songs aren't even supposed to be nuggets of truth. They're supposed to be pieces of art.
Well, let's listen to one. So tell me where is the love?
The song God's Love was written after I saw a religious evolutionist give a talk, and I asked how nature can be interpreted from a religious perspective when there's so much brutality in who lives and who dies. And the answer was simply that we cannot question God's design. We just have to have faith that he loves us, and the suffering in the world is a manifestation of that love somehow. And that didn't sit well with me, and so the result was God's love.
That reminds us, for your thesis in college, you sent questionnaires to over 100 evolutionists. Many of them did not believe in God, were atheists. Some of them said that they did, and their belief in God and science was compatible. They said they could put aside one to study the other. What was your reaction to that?
I was always taught that if you are going to take evolution to its logical conclusion, then you have to basically throw out most of the things that a traditionally religious person holds dear. And so how could these evolutionists see evolution and religion as compatible? And the way they did it was very clever. They blame it on natural selection. And they said that religion is simply a manifestation of natural selection. That somehow living in social groups that happen to believe the same things is very advantageous. Hmm. And that's what they think of as a way of making evolution and religion compatible.
Hmm.
And this, of course, is very offensive, not only to religious people, but to social scientists as well.
Well, but, you know, let's just take that whole line of questioning and apply it just to regular people, because a lot of people do that. They you know, they absolutely fiercely believe in science and evolution, but they also have this other faith. Even one of your band members, I think I was reading, was it Brett Gerowitz, who said,
"Yeah, he's my my co-writer."
He said, "You know, I just believe in God. I just sort of believe in Him, and I don't even know why, but I just do."
He is also a raving atheist. I mean, he doesn't believe that there's a God that you can pray to and get an answer, but he does have a deep sense that, and he really wants to believe that something more exists. I just don't get bothered by people who are believers in God. To me, it's not that serious of an issue. And I don't like being portrayed as somebody who gets angry at the inconsistency of their argument.
What do you, Greg Graffin, believe in?
I believe that if you don't honor other people, then you're pretty much doomed to be miserable. The only joy in living comes from the mix of social experience and the mix of perspectives that comes from people of widely different backgrounds. And if we don't celebrate that, then I think we're pretty much doomed.
Well, now, Greg Graffin, again, lead singer for Bad Religion, you're going to be receiving Harvard's Humanist Chaplaincy Lifetime Achievement Award in Cultural Humanism. And I just want to make a comment, and I just want to say, punk rockers, do not write me. I know what I'm about to say. But, you know, people have this image of punkers, Greg. I mean, humanists, a system of thought that centers on people and their values and beliefs. It's not what we think of when we think of punkers, you know. They're sort of a snarling kind of, I hate everybody.
Punk has a lot of different strains, and it's filled niches that we never imagined were even possible. A lot of the most pop bands that you hear today are actually, they bill themselves as originally listening to punk and being inspired by punk. By the way, nihilism was one of the important early strains in punk music. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I never got behind it. Bad Religion, from the get-go, even when I was 15 years old, I wasn't a nihilist. I was never interested in writing songs that say, who cares about anything? I mean, in fact, when you look at our first album, it's a picture of Los Angeles, Hollywood specifically, with the smog rising above the city. And above the tallest building is the title of the album that says, how could hell be any worse? And what it's asking, it was first of all important because it was asking a question, not giving any answers. And there's always been a concern for making things better. And I find that in a lot of my favorite punk music. It's critical of the way things are, but it's in the interest of raising awareness and in the interest of making a change for the better. And so I guess this award can help maybe put a nail in the coffin of the old idea that punk is equal to nihilism.
Greg Graffin, again, lead singer of Bad Religion. Thanks so much and enjoy your day.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now. Father, can
you hear me? Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.